Okay, thanks. So this is going to be really just a flood of ethnographic information with some interpretation, but not near the level of interpretation of many of the other presenters. But it will show, I think, an example in which this homology of meaning that changes the health status of a person really has some traction, you know, in the way we understand. My background is in anthropology and clinical psychology, and have a very diverse training in psychology from psychodynamic, cognitive perspectives. I worked for a year with real behaviorists, and also learned about hypnosis and various mind-body sorts of things. So I'm going to kind of be coming from this very impure sort of clinical perspective. I bring them together in an anthropology research, and the way I talk about my research is clinical ethnography. So I tend to put myself into different diverse societies and then do ethnography, learning about their ritual life, etc., but also practicing locally and seeing patients who have psychiatric problems of various sorts. The overall goal is to inhabit diverse cultural contexts of illness and healing, including ritual contexts, and to generate findings that are useful for anthropology and for clinical services. And this has required continuous self-reflection on my own biases and other aspects of my personal history so that the ethnocentrism can be controlled and I can begin, hopefully, to understand a very different cultural reality, such as the one I'm going to describe today. And this mode of research resonates strongly with the example of Freud, I think, especially early Freud in the case studies and the interpretations of dreams. Freud, when he's properly put and understood into his historical context, is a foundational model for me of the self-reflective clinical ethnographer immersed in worlds of psychopathology, personal meaning, narratives, and intervention. The domain explored in this conference is the power of symbols, narratives, and meanings. And systems of cultural meaning are not simply representational or referential. I am going to argue that they're also psychoactive. They're pragmatically related to the psychological needs of embodied suffering people. The psychoactive nature of meaning was already known in ancient Greece. So the Stoic philosopher Epictetus argued that emotions are triggered not by events, but by our interpretations of events. And Aristotle, in his Poetics, described the ways in which dramatic plot structures can induce catharsis, purging the audience of emotions such as fear. In studying healing rituals around the world, anthropologists like Claude Lévi-Strauss and Victor Turner have found symbols and implicit narratives to be central organizing structures. Participants ritually enact plot structures, such as the shaman's journey to retrieve a lost soul, such as in the classic paper we're talking about today. But there's also the dramatic removal of a malevolent object or substance from the body, such as in sucking it out by the shaman, ingestion of a sacred medicine or a sacrament, the reenactment of a mythic healing, or a symbolic death and rebirth. In studying this domain, I found a concept called therapeutic emplotment to be extremely useful. Emplotment's a term that generally refers to the placing of events into a plot structure or story. And it has the potential to be a very useful, concise, synthesizing concept for both medical anthropology and clinical services. The term emplotment has been used by historians like Hayden White to describe the ways in which historical events are incorporated into a coherent story by the historian. Narrative theorists and reader response theorists tend to use the term emplotment to describe the imaginative activity of a reader or listener who constructs an understanding of the story and its imagined outcome as they read. Applied to the person in the social world, emplotment describes the person's ongoing narrative engagement with lived reality, such as a patient's struggling after a hopeful or at least coherent story of his or her illness, or the clinician struggling after a narrative that facilitates treatment. As Mary Jo DelVecchio Good and her colleagues argue, the activity of emplotting is not limited to the reader or hearer of stories, but it's a central feature of the way we make sense of life, as well as a crucial imaginative response of those who face the sudden threat of an illness. In addition, emplotment's not merely an intrapsychic process, it also captures the fashioning and deployment of narratives as a purposeful human activity. Anthropological data from a variety of societies around the world have shown that the telling of stories is a powerful means of embedding culturally valued ideas in human minds. And the power of narrative has also been demonstrated in experimental studies. So, for example, Green and Brock found that the experimental subjects' absorption into a story, which they labeled transportation, increases the subject's subsequent story-consisted beliefs and favorable evaluations of the story's protagonists. This effect did not change depending on whether the story was identified as fact or fiction. So stories or plots have an experimentally measurable sort of power or efficacy. And therapeutic intervention frequently aims at changing the suffering person's emplotment of his or her situation, placing events into a story that's not only coherent, but that reflects the goals of the clinical intervention, preserving or generating hope, and moving the patient towards a more therapeutic outcome. In this talk, I'll examine therapeutic emplotment as it operates in the peyote ceremony of the Native American Church. The Native American Church is a post-colonial healing movement among Native North American tribes across the United States and Canada that combines the use of a psychoactive medicine, the peyote cactus, which is a psychedelic, with a symbolically structured ritual process. Thus represents an alternative system of psychiatric pharmacology existing somewhat miraculously in the United States, which is dominated by biomedicine on the one hand and the war on drugs on the other. So the existence of the tradition is a bit of a miracle. Euro-American psychiatry, coming from a Cartesian dualist philosophical base, separates the pharmacological and the meaning-related intervention approaches into separate disciplines of psychiatry and psychotherapy or clinical psychology. This results in psychiatric medicines being administered with little effort to emplot their use in a meaningful way. In contrast, as I will show, within Native American contexts that are not dualist in the same way, psychoactive plant medicines are used to enhance the effectiveness of symbols. So getting into this case, you just need a bit of a background knowledge and to understand the historic context. Though the encounter of Europeans and Native Americans in the New World is often celebrated with optimistic terms like discovery and exploration, this encounter also resulted in what's been called the greatest genocide in human history, and an American Holocaust. As many, by one estimate, as many as 100 million indigenous people died as a result of the European colonization of the Americas, perhaps 90% by European diseases for which there was no immunity. And to this biological onslaught was added the indiscriminate murder of men, women, and children, subjugation, forced labor, and cultural destruction. And the conflict was also a conflict between radically different ways of viewing the world and approaching life. The Native Americans were no doubt shocked by the bearded, white-skinned beings who began haunting their seacoasts, and Europeans were definitely shocked by the cultural differences they encountered, which they often interpreted as signs of an inferior race. And the Spanish, who colonized the Americas initially, sought to exterminate this strangeness through torture, incarceration, public humiliation, burning at the stake, to enforce a Spanish Catholic view of the normal and the sacred. In the context of this conquest, colonial suffering and ethnocentric cultural antagonism, Europeans formed their first opinions of the peyote cactus. It was seen as a strange substance that was used in heathen rituals to contact evil spirits. Its use reinforced indigenous spiritual traditions and blocked the dominance of Christianity. And ethnocentric persecution of followers of the sacred use of peyote began almost as soon as Europeans arrived, and likely the first anti-drug law in North America was created by the Inquisition in 1620 when they labeled peyote the work of the devil. So the Native American societies that survived these events were massively traumatized by the violent conquest, death of loved ones, loss of their lands, and forced acculturation. And today they face health problems that are uniquely severe in many different domains compared to the general population. The situation of disrupted social harmony and health is found in many societies that have experienced conquest and colonialism. And in their book, Postcolonial Disorders, Mary Jo Delvecchio Good and colleagues argue that such situations of societies traumatized by colonialism demonstrate the political at the heart of the psychological and the psychological at the heart of the political. In the wake of conquest and ongoing colonial domination, there were various social attempts at revitalizing the culture of Native American peoples and various attempts at self-healing. And many of these were intertribal in character, bringing together tribal groups that had previously been enemies in many cases. Anthony Wallace is an anthropologist who introduced the term revitalization movements to describe a deliberate, organized, conscious effort by members of a society to construct a more satisfying culture. And this is a sort of movement is common in situations of conquest and you know, political domination. The pain of the conquest often resonates in the ideologies and histories of these revitalization movements among Native Americans. And one of the most influential early movements, the Ghost Dance, honored the dead and predicted their resurrection, as well as a transformation of the world involving the return of previous ways of life, the return of the buffaloes and other game animals, and the disappearance of the Europeans from the land. And this is showing a ghost dance depiction. But the practitioners of the Ghost Dance were crushed by the U.S. Army in 1890 in the Wounded Knee Massacre on the Pine Ridge Lakota Reservation in South Dakota, in a mass killing of men, women, and children. After this ghost dance revitalization attempt declined, or at least it went underground, and that set the stage for the spread of another intertribal revitalization movement called the Native American Church, or the Peyote Religion, which was first described in the late 19th century as a new religious movement spreading among the Oklahoma tribes. Instead of focusing on a transformation of the world through the disappearance of the Europeans, it focused on personal transformation that would allow one to survive in the post-conquest situation, build stronger communities, and avoid the forms of post-colonial disorder like addiction to the white man's alcohol. And this personal transformation was to be achieved through the consumption of a sacred Native American medical substance, the peyote cactus. So the Native American Church is an intertribal revitalization movement focused on healing the ills that came from conquest and colonialism. It's a post-colonial movement. As with the ghost dance and many other practices, it was misunderstood, charges against it were fabricated, and its followers jailed or attacked. But it survived to become the widest ranging Native American religion in North America. So I initiated my project in response to the latest attack at the time, which was the Supreme Court's decision that the followers of the religious tradition could be found guilty of a felony if the states decided to prosecute them. Previously, they had been tolerated by the U.S. government, but with the rise of the war on drugs, intensification of this, the tolerance was withdrawn. And I was very curious about this, and anthropologically, it's a healing tradition under attack. And what's going on with this tradition? Is it drug use in the guise of religion, or is it really a healing movement? And how do we understand it if it is a healing movement? One thing that's clear is Native Americans have been using peyote since about 6,000 years ago. We find the earliest evidence of human use of the cactus. The peyote ceremony is held in a teepee that reflects its origin in the plains, even though even among the Navajos who didn't traditionally have a teepee. So during my 2 years of fieldwork living on the Navajo reservation, I observed a context in which the use of this plant medicine is the glue of community life, shared in family rituals among young and old, and incorporated also, as I found out, into federally funded clinical programs for Native American patients. The Navajos, or as they call themselves, the Diné, which means the people, or the human beings, are an Athapascan-speaking people who have a matrilineal clan-based system of descent. Navajo Nation is a very large area of semi-arid land occupying sections of the states of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. And my field research combined 2 years of immersive field work among Navajos who are members of the church with a concurrent year of clinical work at a Navajo-run treatment program, where I treated adolescents with substance abuse and mental health problems. And the clinical placement immersed me in Native American clinical problems and experiences of suffering, as well as in the local treatment community. So I had the unique experience to work alongside Native a treatment team of Native American therapists. I used various field techniques, including reflecting my clinical training, analyzing my emotional reactions to things in the field, my dreams, etc. And I did observation and interviews, but I also learned practices through doing them, such as participating in various rituals, joining the treatment teams, developing long-term relationships with people. My fieldwork progressed through several phases. During the first summers, I lived with a rural Native American church family in an isolated area, and I earned my living by herding their 150 sheep and goats, and living in their, I was able to live in their traditional dwelling, basically a circular log cabin called a hogan. The grandfather here has been using peyote for the last 40 years with no apparent ill effects. He still goes out and herds cattle and sheep every day. this work gave me a very, you know, experiential understanding of the lives of contemporary NAC members living in a very traditional context. And I attended the family's healing rituals when there was an illness in the family. As I spent subsequent summers, I built my way up in the society from sheepherder and became a clinical worker at a clinical facility run by the Navajo tribe. I don't have a photo of the clinical facility, but it was on the grounds of this Indian Health Services hospital. So one amazing thing I found out getting into the treatment context is that the peyote ceremony is coded and reimbursed as an approved treatment for substance abuse problems. And this is the coding. So literally one hand of the government is saying it's too dangerous to use therapeutically. It's very damaging. And on the other hand, they're paying for its use as a therapy. So that was interesting. There were also elements of the intake forms. Even something as mundane as an intake form revealed the centuries-old clash of cultures. So there was parents signed up their children to go to various different rituals as part of their therapy, and this part of the intake form was the consent for spiritual participation, where the parent can choose from among the options Native American church, traditional Navajo practices, sweat lodge, or Christian domination, please specify. So I knew you would latch on to that beautiful Freudian slip. Okay? And I realized immediately it was supposed to be Christian denomination, but it read Christian domination. And after I brought that to their attention, the clinical team changed the intake form. But this also shows how ritual treatment was individualized to the particular children. Now, the efficacy to me is proven not only with that, but also by a study done by a friend of mine, John Halpern, who compared mental health. He's at McLean Hospital, Harvard teaching hospital, comparing mental health and neuropsychological test results of three groups of Navajos. One group, NAC members who use peyote regularly throughout their life, one group of Navajos with a past alcohol dependence but currently sober at least 2 months, and one group reporting minimal use of any substance. And he found that there was no significant difference between the peyote group and the abstinent group on most scales, but they scored significantly better on two scales of the RAND Mental Health Inventory. So that, as terms of mental health outcomes, they scored the highest on neurological tests and general mental health tests. Also, Carl Menninger wrote in support of the peyote ceremony as well in its efficacy. But the U.S. government hasn't changed much from the Inquisitor's view. Although it is medicinal, yet in its use there are many superstitions with which the Holy Tribunal of the Inquisition has at times punished. Okay, I want to get into the ritual process and just give a quick understanding of how I'm seeing the ritual and its process. So it's an all-night ceremony. It takes place in a teepee that opens to the east to face the rising sun. Inside the teepee, an altar of earth is made in the shape of a half moon or a crescent moon. And in this picture, you see the moon in the center faintly, if you can see it. A line is sketched along the moon that represents the path of your life from birth to death as an arc. So you begin on the left side at birth, you raise in potency to adulthood, and then you begin your decline into old age and death. So it's a finite depiction of your life course. It's also, however, said when I interviewed Navajos about the meanings of the moon, they also said it's a symbol of transformation and change because the moon changes by growing and shrinking once a month, unlike the sun. And the Navajos said that the moon represents the natural processes of gestation because the human life takes 9 moons or 9 months to create a new life. So just in this one symbol, we have a rhetorical maneuver. We have the self or the life course symbolically embedded in transformation. So the implicit message is one that yourself, your life is in this process of natural transformation. And the teepee also plays a role in this gestation symbolism. Navajos explained that the teepee in the ceremony represents a female with a blanket facing east. And the beating of the peyote drum is meant to replicate the sound of your mother's heartbeat as heard from inside the womb. So they train you to drum in this way that replicates the heartbeat. And death comes into the symbolism as well, creating the well-known death and rebirth plot structure, one of the very, you know, we encounter it a lot cross-culturally. One NEC member, for example, referred to the sitting place of the patient in the teepee as the death chamber from which people hope to emerge. So there's a death to the old self that opens the possibility of a birth to a new self. And the timing of the ritual is another tool that contributes to this therapeutic implantment. The ritual begins at night at the ending of one day and moves the patient symbolically to the beginning of a new day, accompanied by many symbols of rebirth, renewal, and transformation. And at dawn, the peyote adherents exit this maternal symbol and greet the sun in a symbolic, creating the symbolic rebirth. And peyote itself is an important symbol seen as a sacred medicine, but also as a spiritual entity. And peyote visions often are interpreted as communications from the peyote spirit or God or Jesus, depending on the background of the adherent. Symbols come together in local artistic productions like this one and in life-changing visions or healing experiences that occur in the rituals. So my friend Hosky became, as a young man, lost his vision. And he went, although he was raised in the religion, he became very depressed and alcoholic. And somebody brought him to a peyote meeting trying to reconnect him with his heritage. And he gave this account. He said, I went through some depression after I lost my vision in 72. I was at a meeting and I ate some medicine. This is what they call peyote. And I sat back and something happened. I don't know if I went asleep or what, but I had a vision. Or I don't know what it was, a dream. I was out somewhere with some friends and we were drinking. And I was carrying a can of beer and the moonlight was shining. And I could see that can of beer open like this. And all of a sudden I heard a noise, laughing and guys having a time behind me. I was walking away from them and all of a sudden I heard a shot. I heard two shots from a gun. Next thing I knew, there's a graveyard up on a hill near where I live. And this voice told me, if you don't make up your mind, this is where you're headed. And he said that was his healing experience that triggered a behavioral change. And he went on to become a very influential healer on the reservation. And actually he was the CEO of the treatment facility that I did my year-long clinical placement at. So we see some of the primary features of the symbolism even in this vision. There's the moon. The moonlight is there. The voice of peyote. The reflection on one's path of life. And the death and rebirth experiences, encounter with death leading to a renewal. And we can see how the state of self-reflection reinforced by the symbolism structured a vision that produced therapeutic insight and behavioral change. So in this case, like the Kuna Shaman's song, the implantment allows the symbol, symbolic or narrative structure of the ceremony bears a structural resemblance to the radical healing transformation that's sought by participants. So here we have, unlike the therapist and patient, we have a plot structure that's not improvised and fashioned between the two in a dyadic creative way, extemporized, but it's fixed and embedded in tradition and then applied to the patient. I use the term culturally embedded therapeutic emplotment for this. I mean, it links with ritual symbolism on the one hand and all these larger structures of emplotment that are built into culture at the writ large, you know, the healing sacrifice of Jesus, saving everybody, or any other of these large karma, you know, creating a just universe, etc. So I wanted to turn now, we see this meaning structure, I wanted to turn briefly to the role of the medicine itself as I see it. In the peyote ceremony, this emplotment of the patient in a narrative structure is aided by a technique of consciousness modification through the ingestion of peyote that renders the mind more malleable and open to suggestion. And this became very obvious to me when I was trained in hypnosis myself. And there I found studies such as this one done at Stanford finding that mescaline, the psychoactive ingredient in peyote, enhanced experimental subjects' primary suggestibility to the level of a hypnotic induction. So this is a very different understanding of therapeutic process than we're used to, right? Pharmacological intervention for mental illness in a familiar context doesn't aim to transform the patient's interpretation of their life. It micromanages mood states at a molecular level. And once again, as I said before, there's not a lot of work to add a meaning to the medicine. It's not emplotted. It's separate from the meaningful work of the psychoanalyst or psychotherapist. But in this context, the medicine and the meaning system work together in tandem. And I refer to this as a semiotic slash reflexive paradigm of psychopharmacology as opposed to the agonist-antagonist paradigm that we're used to. Pharmacology is used to facilitate creative shifts in perspective, bringing the person into a particular plot structure or story, and generating insight. So, narratives and interpretations matter in this particular pharmacological approach. And in one of the, I'll share one of the very prominent narratives, that's the origin myth of how Native Americans found peyote. So as the story goes, this woman was participating in a hunting trip with fellow hunters from her tribe, and a group of warriors attacked these hunters, and in the process, many were unfortunate and others ran to safety. Among the unfortunate was this one woman. She was wounded from her war party and left behind by her people to die. And through all her suffering, she became lost and helpless in the desert. But out of this desolation and terror, she heard a voice speak to her, first through a dream, and then after she woke from the dream. And the voice said, "Eat the sacred plant that's growing beside you. That is life and all the richest blessings for you and your Indian people." And she turned her head against the earth's surface. She partook of the plant. And through the partaking, she was healed. So it seems that this story symbolically represents the experience of Native Americans, a Native American person who's encountered peyote and is healed from illness or social isolation on the level of the individual. But the character's tribe was also attacked by a group of warriors, which resonates with the conquest of the entire population. And the character of the story is characterized by as being alone, wounded, separated from the group, which is a potent symbol of the post-conquest situation for many Native Americans. Alienation from mainstream society, intergenerational trauma, community disruption. And once again, she hears a voice, which is the same as for the actual ritual participants. And how am I doing on time? Okay, so I'll try to wrap up quickly. So this story, again, has this illness healing narrative structure going from death to rebirth, symbolically. So I'll just conclude and This conference, again, was framed in terms of the therapeutic power of symbols and Levi-Strauss's comparison of this efficacy with Freud's psychoanalysis. Both ritual symbolic efficacy and Freudian psychoanalysis demonstrate the power of particular narrative framings and systems of interpretation to have a therapeutic or an anti-therapeutic effect. However, the ritual healing we usually see in the anthropological literature is not as close in structure to Freud's psychoanalysis, perhaps, as it is to his earlier pressure technique, if you remember the pressure technique, this ritual gesture pressing against the head of the person to create, you know, this stream of images. Much more ritualistic. Both appear to depend on suggestion and are thus more related to hypnosis than to Freud's later techniques. However, the peyote ceremony specifically is almost like free association or dream analysis because of the visions that are that represent the unconscious wishes and fears and are interpreted by the person themselves. So I see the ritual process as this dialectic between a symbolic structure, which does have a homologous relationship to the desired outcome, and it delivers a, in combination with the peyote, which alters suggestibility, the meaning structure of the ritual delivers a post-hypnotic suggestion, aided by the effects of the peyote to trigger self-reflection, make the mind more suggestible, and create these symbolically structured dreamlike visions. And the peyote itself might be this blank screen for projection, possibly, because it's there, it can become a focus of prayer and can talk back to you. So I will end there, and if you want to read further, I've published a book on this that you can find that goes into everything in more detail. Thanks a lot. Look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much, and we have about 10 minutes for questions, so opening it up to the floor.
And then I'll take this to the... How important would you say to the efficacy of this ceremony is it that it's taking Native Americans back to their heritage? How much is that part of the whole impact?
Yeah, that's crucial to understand, that it's reorganizing Native American communities because of the value system of the religion. You know, rules like don't use alcohol, rules like be faithful to your family and your wife, your spouse, and also the rejection of this invading Euro-American substance, alcohol, in favor of this Native American substance that's seen as a product of nature and benign. So I think that's, yeah, crucial to understand that it's a revitalization of Native American values, but in a way that can allow them to live in the world that they're in rather than rejecting it as in the ghost dance.
Yeah, but for them individually, is it important that they are making a link back to their own heritage and past? And is that part of the therapeutic process, do you think?
It certainly is. Yeah. If they become alienated, maybe they've even forgot their clan that they were in, and that's taught to them again. They're taught to respond to each other in the proper kinship term, to other people. And so they realize now their identity again. Yeah, that's an important part of it.
Thank you. Can you comment a bit more about on the issues that and struggles that people are going through that are the reason why perhaps they find this, you know, a source of solace and change and so on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people talk about the, you know, issues of identity, who are, you know, kind of questions about who they really are. Yeah. You know, where they come from. You know, the kind of the struggle against deprivation and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you see this particular therapy in the context of the whole range of needs of this population?
Yeah, so I think it's the real problems you see on the reservation are very high suicide rates, especially among the youth, use of a variety of negative kinds of substances, the inhalation of petrol, crystal meth among the young people, lots of violence, domestic violence, and basically just very dissatisfied with life. And in a way, the traditionalists might be more likely to not find their way to harmony, because that would mean accepting the conquest, right? So, and it's almost being a true Native American to be dissatisfied. It's kind of a situation of eudysphoria, maybe you can compare it to. But this radical transformation allows these people to generate something brand new in terms of their personality structure and their goals, and it gives them this value system and path to life that allows them, maybe they don't, you know, have the dominance again in this land, but they've learned to accept, to create this mental health. The mental health is a creative construction that they establish with the ritual, basically.
I think I'm connecting it to the symbols, but how important is it for somebody to have a cultural, almost genetic connection to, can't quite articulate what I'm trying to say. Do you have to be part of the culture to have benefit from something like this ritual? Right. Or can other people from other cultures find something in those symbols that will give them the same healing?
I think it's probably a matter of degree. I think conceivably somebody could be touched by the symbolism or the ritual, but in a very performative aspect, as we were talking about, this understanding of the performance and how it impacts us, and we project meanings onto it. But I would say in this tradition, the children are taught from a very young age that this peyote spirit exists. It can become this morally evaluative deity. There's almost a panoptical sort of child-rearing goal that this all-seeing spirit will follow them around, and then they don't get into trouble. And they believe in the healing power, as well as when they have a bad experience, such as they vomit or they have a bad trip, that's explained through what they've been taught, that that's the peyote teaching you, or you're ridding your body of sin, etc. So all those mechanisms, I think, allow for, safer use with less problems, although I wouldn't just limit it necessarily, the healing or benefits, to just those people raised in the tradition. Certainly there are expectancy effects that are created by enculturation that help.
I think my question kind of links on to that. I was going to say, do you think that peyote could have a beneficial place in Western medicine? As in the Western world?
If it wasn't such a taboo. Conceivably, but you'd have to have people guiding, because I think in the West we have this notion of recreational use. They have a much different notion. And once again, this is emplotment considered very broadly, not just in the ritual, but in the culture. For example, they wouldn't abuse peyote because it's seen as having a mind and is sacred, and for that reason you don't abuse it, or it will take revenge on you. And that creates the ability to use this without a lot of problems. Whereas if you look at it recreationally, I mean, it's the difference between smoking tobacco in a sweat lodge in a traditional way versus chain smoking, you know. You can see how the ritual itself and the structure, the plot structure attached to the medicine controls it in a way. So it's once again possible, but there are many problems potentially to deal with on the way.
Could I ask a question, actually? Uh-huh. I'm just wondering about the need for order in this idea of therapeutic implotment. And is it always a coherent narrative that brings about a therapeutic effect, could there be a value from a disruptive, such thing as a sort of disruptive therapeutic implotment, or plots that are therapeutic in a disruptive way?
Well, I don't know how to answer if they usually don't have, I mean, certainly the peyote can give you a vision that's very upsetting to you, and then you have to interpret what the message is. So that can happen.
So there is disruption in the experience.
Now, I don't know if you were getting on to maybe, you know, coherence of the message, and if that has to be coherent as in the structure. I mean, but what if you were touching on that, they're not given this plot or narrative form as a whole piece. They're given little hints piecemeal here and there. It's the moon is your life, and then somebody else may tell them the moon is about the transformation. Then they all merge it together in the ceremony, and that merging together can be very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, destabilizing when they have it. And who knows how much of this operates outside of awareness as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the disruptive part, I'm not sure I know exactly what you mean, but it certainly is always going to be interpreted in a way as, how is this message from God or peyote useful to me? What is it trying to teach me?
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're suffering, even if you have a tough time of it in the ritual.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you have answered your question. I think my question was really about, is this Levi-Straussian idea of, in the end, everyone has to find their place in a kind of ordered plot, which I'm intuitively sort of resistant to. But, but I think what you're describing is saying that that's not the story at all. And in fact, it seems like a much more complicated negotiation of taking elements of a story that make sense and struggling with integrating them, actually. It's not just about...
Yeah, and maybe you latch on to certain parts that are more meaningful to you, and that becomes what Obia Sacri, you know, calls personal symbol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that happens a lot. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
From what you described, I could see some similarities with the use of ayahuasca in Amazon.
Yeah.
So do you think it is something that can be mapped in the Americas, or in Africa you can also find similar?
Well, you find the Bwiti religion in Africa, and that's very similar. It uses a bush that's psychedelic for initiation and meeting the ancestors and things like that. Maybe because of the rise of Christianity and other world religions in the old world, we have much less of this sort of. Maybe it's been rooted out. I don't know. But in the new world, you find these sort of traditions very prominent throughout. But even the shamans, the classic shamans among the Siberians, use the Amanita muscaria mushroom. So there's a lot of parallel traditions out there, I have to say. Thank you very much.
There's a question at the back.
Oh, there is.
Hello.
Sorry, I suppose the other level of resignification that I was thinking about is the way that your work and the work that you were kind of citing is resignifying medicine. So resignifying Western conceptions of medicine and disrupting them with other ways of relating between sort of medicine and other cultural practices. Is that a kind of resignification you would associate with?
I didn't hear the first part of what you said. Are you talking about the Native American church members' use of the word medicine for pain?
No, I'm talking about your work contributing to a resignification of medicine.
And the word you're saying?
Resignification.
Oh, resignification of medicine. I'm certainly, in my mind, what I'm doing is trying to question our usual concepts of therapeutic, what is therapeutic and what is normal. And I'm finding a lot of diversity in how people find their way to, you know, I see, you know, mental health basically as a creative implotment that can be arrived at in many different, through many different paths. And that leads to all these different viable forms of therapy and human development. I don't know. I think that answers your question maybe. So it is a challenge to our usual notions of what is therapy.
We've got a bit of time. Does the cure always come as a kind of epiphany?
Hmm.
Or are there other forms of yeah. transformation.
Yeah. Well, you, as in any of these ritual healing traditions, sometimes people are just, you know, they just report a healing just kind of coming out of nowhere, and there wasn't necessarily a communication through a vision. That can happen, certainly. And you don't know how to explain that. It's very neat when you have the communication and then you can analyze it symbolically. But there's also just, you know, coming out of nowhere, sort of somebody just, maybe it was a mood. Maybe it was nothing as coherent as a message or a voice from peyote. Maybe it was just the mood they had that was transformative, or the feeling, or the social support, or the identity issues. All that comes into play.
Yeah. Just, well, this might sound a bit facetious, but does anybody go into a ritual like that who feels they're too normal and then wants to come out a bit more...
abnormal.
You know, yeah. there's something about, you know, and...
I mean, they might feel
that the peyote spirit on their shoulder telling them what to do, this, that, and the other...
Oh.
...is too much.
Right.
And they're trying to get away from that and free themselves up a bit. I mean, yeah. Does that ever happen?
There's a pattern, you know, you see it among the Amish, for example, where the children will rebel and go away and do something anti-Amish. For the peyote kids... that might be going and having a beer. And then their parents would get upset with them, and you know, sometimes I hear the old people say, these kids today, they're not serious, they don't take a lot of peyote in the meetings. and they snuck off and had a Budweiser, you know, I mean, so I think, but then often they're trying to pull them back, just as with the Mormons. So I do see that life course period in my identity formation, I'm going to reject what my parents want me to do. But I haven't seen anybody go to a ceremony for that. They would go to a liquor store if they wanted to, you know, indicate their rebellion.
Sorry, I'm very curious about this, but you mentioned Utah, so the National Reserve is, and we know that in Utah, many Mormons, it's the kind of the state of Mormons and so on. So, as I'm from Brazil, I observe, we know the syncretism. So do you observe something similar in a syncretism between this religion and others? And
well, the Native American church is not very doctrinaire, so you can be from various different backgrounds, and many Navajos participate in Mormonism and Christianity and traditionalist rituals, including my friend Hosky, who had a lot of Mormon teachings. So I think, yeah, there is a blending, and they don't see the need to be pure necessarily in one or the other, unless they're Christian exclusively, or maybe some of the traditionalists. But the peyote people, they can be praying to Jesus or to a Native American deity right next to each other in the teepee, and there's no contradiction necessarily. Multi-religious in that way.
I think we're starting to kind of segue into the plenary anyway, and I was wondering, there were a couple of things that you mentioned that I think might help us to link to some of the other talks that we've heard today. And one thing that I wanted to ask is really to do with the kind of peculiar legal status of peyote itself and how that might play out in the context of this idea of symbolic effectiveness. And I was quite struck by, there are perhaps a few links to be drawn. Boris was talking earlier about this idea that perhaps symbolic effectiveness has its guarantee in something to do with there being a point in a narrative where perhaps the hook of implotment being a kind of blank space where something... and then we've had Darian talking about this idea of something, of this appeal to a different register. And I was really struck by this wonderful Freudian slip that you reported. The idea that, in a sense, the appeal to peyote belongs with this kind of series of what Darian calls appeals to other registers, registers that are outside the law. So I was wondering how you thought that this idea of the strange legal status, and obviously the history of that legal status, may play out in the cure itself.
Do you mean, is the cure in some way powerful because it's going against the standard assumptions of the dominant culture, the colonial power?
Well, on the one hand, I mean, you could read this idea of the this kind of it kind of holds out a place beyond Christian domination.
It
right?
does. It does.
And of course, you read that in a kind of Foucauldian tradition in anthropology, where you could kind of read it as a kind of hidden transcript mm-hmm. of resistance. But at the same time, it seems to have these wonderful resonances with Levi-Strauss, in the sense of that idea of a zero symbol, a point that has no other function except to guarantee the law.
Mm-hmm. I guess I hesitate at the, because there's so much meaning attributed to the peyote, that I hesitate to kind of treat it as this sort of blank space, although there certainly is projections onto that are then, I mean, it is useful to take a part of yourself and externalize it and then talk to it, right? So I think that's going on quite a bit, but it's not completely oppositional to or denial of Christianity, because there's a lot of syncretism between the Native American church and Christianity. It's almost a Native American version of Christianity on some level. Or in a way, it's a Native American version of democracy, because the shamanic trance is not only taken then by the shaman, but everybody in the teepee can be their own shaman and just download information off the spiritual net. Curative information or diagnostic information. So, yeah, I kind of, I don't know, maybe, I don't know, I have to think about it some more, possibly. Somebody else could help me with that.
I'm just wondering, one way of thinking about it is maybe to ask why you think the peyote became this sort of central symbol around which everything is organized. And I mean, it certainly seems to have quite a complex status as a symbol, and because it stands in for the, presumably, the drug-induced state to all kinds of things. But right. So, but why specifically around this plant?
I think it's potential and its therapeutic application, which allows these people to generate an extremely different form of subjectivity under this conquest situation. Mm-hmm. And it's almost that it takes that radical an intervention to get people off this path of self-destruction and to generate this new sort of mental health. That's how I see it anyway. It just happened to be that it was, they knew about this substance, it spread, the ritual did transform people and provide these healings, reinvigorated spirituality and community. It certainly was a Native American substitute for this alcohol. So there's kind of this diametrically opposed between white man's invented fire water and this natural substance.
So just so I'm getting it clear, you think it's the experience of the altered state that in a sense is the starting point of all the other elaborations?
And its ability to allow ritual to transform people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's another part of it, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask whether it's ever blamed, whether POT is ever...
For a problem.
Because it might engender guilt if you're not receiving it in the right way, or can it be blamed for negative behavior response, or?
Well, by non Native American church members, it quite often is blamed.
But not
for Native American church members.
So it's always positive.
It's really like a panacea.
It's always positive. That's extraordinary.
It is. Even when it gives you a very horrifying vision, there's always a therapeutic reason for why the peyote gave you that. That you it's up to
so
you
it's
to
very,
figure out.
It's all powerful. It's like a god.
It's omniscient and it is omnipresent, so it can serve this panoptical surveillance.
Does it engender guilt in the same way that our Christian god?
I didn't get into talking about the young people and their development within this religion, but I see it very much in terms of superego formation, right? This thing is monitoring them. They learn how to monitor themselves under this, you know, Foucauldian surveillance kind of regime.
Sounds
and then,
terrifying to me.
But it's very benign, though. It has your best interests at heart.
That's what they said.
Oh, well, yeah.
Right, we've got 15 minutes or so just to... The three of you can go on... The three remaining speakers can go on the stage and we'll just open up to general mm-hmm. questions. Any puzzles, thoughts, or unless you want to go first? Yeah, you haven't spoken yet. Yeah, okay. Just general reflections.
I hope it's related. I'm interested in the symbol of colours, and I wondered if any of you have any particular points of interest that you can reflect on in your research about the way colours are being utilised as symbols. I don't know if I've said that clearly, but mm-hmm. that's where I'm thinking about doing a dissertation at the moment.
Tradition.
Might be a bit specific that. But,
well, it'd be interesting just to hear whatever the responses are, actually. Did you have any experiences of colour when you were either in your dreams or with the people? Were you struck by colour?
Just my colour. Well, working with Native Americans.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
My friend Toski used to, when I get in the sweat lodge, he used to say, one of you needs more browning. which was had us all these metaphorical, you know, kind of associations, which are kind of like a little bun that, you know, you cook up a little bit and get rid of the whiteness if you can. So certainly ethnic color came into it quite a lot.
I once did a course, believe it or not, on fashion. And it was a bit of a problem, but I did discover something quite interesting, which is that it's a complete faux pas to wear white socks with shoes and to show them under your trousers. But I also discovered that in Belgium, it's an equal faux pas to wear red socks under it. So, I mean, basically, you don't have colours, you have colour schemes, which can be arbitrary and can mean things in different, you know. And so in any different culture, there might be a particular colour scheme, but the meanings wouldn't be symbolic. I mean, it'd be like what Darien said, divorced from the, you know, a particular reference. So that's all I think about it.
I'm not so much interested in the meanings, but the experience of colour.
See,
and whether it feels...
Whether different colours feel, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's a good something to experiment on to see whether, say, there's cultures where they feel that a particular colour has a healing property, or the same in another culture that colour might have an opposite property, perhaps. But
I was just saying, in response to that, there's Harold. Thank you. In response to that, Harold Conklin in the Philippines, the Hanuna, they see colours in different ways. So colours can have a texture. And there's different ways of categorising different colours, not according to the same primary or whatever. That's right.
And sorry, actually, I've just remembered there's also a recent book about this particular shade of pink. Have you come across it? Which is used, there was research done on it. Research has been done on it, and as a result, a number of prisons, I mean, this is symbolic efficacy, a number of American prisons have been repainted this particular shade of pink, and the idea that it's kind of pacifies the inmates. And apparently also now one large American football team have got the kind of visiting lockers painted the same pink, you know, in the hope that will dampen the spirits of... it's got a... Does anyone know this? I forgot what the... It's got a particular name, this shade of... Particular shade of pink is a bizarre thing. And there's a debate about, is this cultural, is it neurological or neurophysiological? Yeah.
Thank you. Actually, Boris, I was wondering if we could go back to your paper, if I can remember well enough after lunch. Some of the interesting issues you were discussing in the differences between Levi-Strauss and, I guess, his student, Saveri. I thought it was a really interesting paper in that I was wondering if one kind of comment, one way you might be able to read some of the differences you were foregrounding is that in the Levi-Strauss paper, you have the issue of and it seems like he got the facts wrong, right? But that you had this issue of giving, possibly you could read it as moving from the imaginary to the symbolic, in that the body was given, the body corresponded, experiences in the body were given a symbolic geography instead of terms and everything. But then in your paper, you said that Saveri noticed that actually, you know, that the languages that were being spoken, didn't make any sense to the patient, and that it was much more about gaps and doubts and that kind of thing. And maybe even, I'm not sure if I'm getting the terminology right, but that could be about the symbolic and the real, the move from one to the other. I'm not quite sure, but in any case, I guess it's too bad Darian isn't here, but the question I kind of have is, do you think that you two ended up having a different idea of what the cure was really about?
You two...
You and Darian in your presentations of the case, do you think the idea of how the cure was actually affected?
No, I found actually that I recognized a lot of... No, I didn't think there was incompatibility there. On the contrary, I thought I recognized a lot. It is a shame he isn't here, and it might be better to have the conversation with him, but... No, and on the first part of your question, the Saveri reworking of the Levi-Strauss theory ends up actually with a curiously close explanation to Levi-Strauss's original explanation, except that, in a sense, I mean, Levi-Strauss is saying the shaman provides a language, and Saveri is basically saying the shaman provides empty signifiers. But there's still a similar kind of dynamic of this supply by... the shaman of a symbol, except that it's been emptied of kind of pre-coded semantic meaning, just becomes sound. But there's a close proximity. And generally, I mean, I find Saveri's book and his work generally fascinating, and there are these kind of quite deep departures. But you can also see... Levi-Strauss's essay is part of a group of essays, and he's working through a lot of topics... I can see a lot of Levi-Strauss's concerns being taken up quite subtly. For example, the whole idea about doubt. The companion essay to the symbolic efficacy one is about a trial of somebody for witch hunt, for witchcraft, and it's about this boy on trial, gradually realizing the trial isn't going well, and changes tack and actually starts to confirm all the accusations made against him, and actually brings proof to these accusations. And yes, I used this feather. And it really was a paper about the group seeking through this trial confirmation of some kind of symbolic order. But what was interesting was actually the position of doubt, or the situation of doubt in which all the protagonists are placed in at the start, which I think filters through to Saveri's ideas about religion and doubt and tension around that.
Ivan's asked me to say something that I was talking to him about at lunchtime, so I'll see if I can try and remember what that was. But, I mean, essentially, I think I'll start in the crassest possible way. When I reread the essay this week for the first time in 40 years, and looking at the way that I'd underlined it, and that first time I approached it in a completely different way, actually, you know, which your talk confirms. I mean, I read it as a young man, as a true believer, you know. I thought, wow, stories can change people's lives, stories can cure people, you know, and I'm a dramatist, you know, so kind of it's a foundation myth that we, you know, we are changing lives by telling stories, you know. But then when you told us about Saveri's work and the fact that, you know, that relation of communication was not quite so direct as it seemed to be in the way Levi-Strauss talks it. I was thinking about, essentially, power relations between the shaman and the patient, the way that languages, yes, I agree with what the chap was saying this morning, that there's no such thing as non-communication. But on the other hand, there must be, you know, in the Levi-Strauss article, you get the idea that the woman must know what the shaman is talking about, that she must share that symbolic thing. But if, you know, what you've now, you've thrown this in to complicate things. And I was thinking of other instances where language, is not understood by, again, in drama, in any situation in drama, there's always a power relationship. You know, you're always looking when you're analysing a play or when you're writing a play, you say, who's on top, who's on bottom, how are they changing that, how is this being transformed through interaction. Catholic Mass was mentioned, well, that was a way Protestants would see as being obscuring the relationship between an individual and God, and therefore, you know, we have to get rid of that power. So anyway, all I'm saying is that when there's a healer and a patient, is there always a power relationship, and is that that difficulty of language part of the way that that will be expressed?
I don't know really how to answer about the power relationship, but in terms of the rest of your question, I think sort of drama and theatre is quite a useful way of thinking about Severi's model, because in a way he's saying that communication isn't just about the meaning of words, which is also what Darian was saying this morning, I think, again, where we agree. And so, say, if you imagine a theatrical setting, you've got whatever the characters might be saying, but you've got a stage, you've got dynamics of people entering and exiting, you've got a particular way of saying things, and basically Severi's starting point for explaining the functioning of this ritual is saying that all these things are what matter and what are generating meaning and what are being used, even if the words aren't understood.
Just add one tiny thing. I mean, you know, the thing that so became a kind of mantra on first reading this was the quotation from Rambo that metaphor can change the world.
Yeah.
Do we think it can? I mean, that seriously, you know.
It could probably change the way people behave. I'm sure, you know, what is it, metaphors people live by? I certainly think, yes, that absolutely. Metaphors are probably extremely important in terms of symbolic forms, understanding symbolic forms that are efficacious. Maybe actually we haven't talked enough about metaphors. I think there are a lot of implicit metaphors, and they have a property of sort of slipping under the radar and becoming adopted, and I think they can be extremely structuring, organizing of reactions politically. You know, just look at the political use of metaphors. Yes, absolutely.
And also in that technical sense that in the early Lacan, he's making a kind of equation between, in Lacan's early take on the Oedipus complex, between the kind of zero symbol of Levi-Strauss, this kind of symbol from another register, and what he calls the name of the father. So that Lacan sort of says completes the symbol, whereas slightly later on Lacan talks about this in terms of a metaphorical operation. But as for the kind of question of the power dynamics, I suppose there's also the question of, is psychoanalysis inducing kind of bringing out an individual myth? And I think that would be part of the treatment, in which case, you know, there are questions about whose knowledge it is. But also that psychoanalysis is perhaps a practice that can be differentiated in the sense that it's about perhaps calling into question and differentiating the story that you might have constructed about your life and trying to take that apart in some way. And there's a concept in Lacanian psychoanalysis called the subject supposed to know. And it's the idea that the patient, and often through kind of very enigmatic, this is very interesting, very enigmatic interventions of the analyst. If any of you have had the misfortune to be in Lacanian psychoanalysis, you'll know that the analyst just never says anything that makes any sense whatsoever. And you end up constructing your own story. You end up kind of rehearsing your habitual transferential ways of phantasmatically dealing with that relationship. And it's about taking that apart. So that's just another, something to throw into the mix.
I might just comment that there are real differences in different therapeutic approaches between them in the power of the practitioner and how the power is constructed. So I recall, you know, being first trained in very non-directive psychotherapy, which I'm just Joe, I'm not doctor whatever, and you know, we just talk. And then I was trained in hypnosis. in which the whole idea is you're building up this reputation that you know exactly what's going on in the patient's mind and you can reach in there and rearrange things. And it's very, it was very jarring to go from one role like that to now I'm all magical and I can do all these things and playing up on that. And that maybe is where much more like the shaman, right? Very different, you power dynamic going on in that sort of intervention.
Okay. I think I'm going to assume what everybody's, what's going on in everyone's mind, which is wanting a cup of tea. So we'll leave that for now and just thanks for the speaker.